So we get up to the target. The Bradley maneuvered into position, and there's like this tank round just flies out of nowhere. And then you start to hear like tink, 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 and the ramp goes down. And we peel out, and I ran towards the target building. And as I like clear all the stuff, there's smoke and stuff, and I just get this weird feeling like not everybody's with me. So I kind of like take a knee. And I'm like waiting. Nobody's running by me, and I'm realizing you hear like snap, snap, snap. And then all of a sudden, like I get the squeeze, and it's Mark behind me. So we go up to the front door. So I ran up, kicked it open, and it propels me past the first two rooms. I'm like on my gun the whole time, and I just give the going upstairs. And as me and Chucky get to the top of the stairs, this machine gun fire just comes in, dude. And it comes in heavy. You could tell it was really close. And all of a sudden, you hear man down, like dire man down. And then he goes, we need a foreman down here now. So I just, it's like three bounds down the stairs, and I get down to the stairwell. As we're coming down, I go to grab Mark, and another bunch of machine gun fire comes down through there. So I kind of like duck out of the way, and Mark is, dude, he's down. And Nick, our EOD guys, returning fire. I catch Nick's eye. It looked like sheer terror, the look that he gave me. So grab Mark, and I drag him around that little alcove, and I just start cutting Mark's gear off. You know, it was pretty apparent that he took one round right to the teeth. I could see the whole left side was already bruising. You could see it all on his cheek. His face was like white, and Mark was tan. I get the gear off, and dude, I'm just doing like a quick assessment. And dude, there's nothing, man. I was like, we need a Casovac now. It's like, all right, it's outside. So I go and I sling Mark up on there and I start carrying him, dude. And it, it's heavy. You know what I mean?
GlobalRecon.net, giving you the matter of facts. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Hendricks. I am on with former U.S. Navy SEAL Chris Osmond. Chris, how's it going, brother?
Great, man. How you doing today?
I'm all right. It's cool to have you on, Chris. You've had an interesting career in the military, served in two different branches. So let's start with what motivated you to join the military?
You know, I grew up in a military family. I'm from San Diego. My father served. My uncles all were in the military. And, you know, I just thought it was the thing to do. And since I was a young kid, I've always wanted to be in the military, just fascinated by it. And, you know, I grew up around it and saw all the movies, you know, read a bunch of books and things like that as a kid. And I just knew it was always, you know, it was just something I was always going to do. So that's why I wanted to do it.
Cool. And how'd you end up joining? Because you kind of had a unique experience getting in there.
Yeah. So my entire childhood, you know, I was like, I want to be in the Navy, 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 Navy. And, you know, of course, you know, back then it was just like Navy SEALs. And, you know, they didn't have all the press they have now. But, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I grew up in San Diego. I had a father that was in the military. So he used to take me down to the SEAL team base. He knew a bunch of SEALs because they had, you know, been on his submarines. And my father was the command master chief. So he was the chief of the boat. So he had a lot of pull. And then, you know, I got to go down and take tours and do all kinds of stuff with a couple of friends of mine. And I was just hooked on it. That's, you know, I was like, that's what I want to do. And I looked up to those guys, man, you know, the blue and gold shirts back in the day, right? The jungle boots with the socks rolled down over the top and, yeah. You know, the green covers. I just thought it was just, they were like superheroes, man, like walking giants, right? And, but, you know, I'm a typical kid and kind of all over the place, but really wasn't focused. And the neighborhood I grew up in, yeah, I grew up in Southeast San Diego. Off of, you know, kind of a place called Skyline Drive. So, you know, my brother went to Morris High School. It's kind of a rough neighborhood, if you will, you know, especially for a white kid. And that's where I kind of developed my attitude of just not really taking any shit off anybody. And so we were constantly getting into trouble, constantly fighting, always around a lot of trouble. And, you know, I developed a little criminal record, a juvenile criminal record, and experimented with drugs and did all that stuff. So when I went to go join the Navy, you know, the Navy recruiter was like, yo, man, this isn't for you. If you join the Navy, you're going to get involved with the wrong element and you should join the Marine Corps instead. And I was just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Right? Because I grew up in a Navy family, right? And he goes, no, man, the Marine Corps is going to give you the discipline you need. So I agreed to it. And, you know, he's like, and I was like, are you sure, man? He goes, yeah, look, think about it. You have to spend the same 4 years. So do you want to become a Marine and actually like do some training and learn something about the military and learn something about yourself? Or he goes, you know, you're going to be a shithead in the Fleet Navy, you know, chipping paint, doing nothing. And I was like, all right. So literally like get up out of the chair in his office. We walk next door and he introduces me to the Marine recruiter, a guy named Sergeant Peters from New York, who I'll never forget. And they were like laughing when I was like, oh yeah, I got a, you know, criminal record and I have drug use. And they're like, oh, dude, the Marine Corps will take you, man. Sit down. you know, it's unique. So that's how I ended up in the Marine Corps. You know, and I'm basically like, hey man, I paid for my sins as a juvenile there. I can tell you that. But it was great, man. I loved the experience. It was cool.
Right on. So you spent how many years in the Marine Corps before you transitioned into the Navy?
I was in the Marine Corps for 4 years, and I was artillery. And during that time, I screened for the battalion recon that we had. And back then, it wasn't a primary MOS like it is now. So they considered that a secondary MOS. But in order to get into reconnaissance, you had to either have an O3, like a grunt background, be motor T, or a communicator. And I was artillery, so I took the screening test. I passed everything. I had recommendations from my chain of command, but the Marine Corps just wouldn't let me do it. They're like, hey, man, sorry, you don't have the right primary MOS. And so in my 4 years was coming to an end, I called a Navy recruiter in Oceanside, and I asked him if I could leave the Marine Corps and join the Navy to go to BUDS. And he was like, yeah, man, I just did it for a staff sergeant that left force recon. He goes, so I know exactly how to do it. And I mean, literally that day, as soon as I got off, man, I was in my car in his office and spent the next, I'm gonna say it was like 4.5 months, you know, doing the paperwork, taking the ASVAB test, doing the medical screening. I did all that stuff so I could transition and leave the Marine Corps and join the Navy on the same day. And that's what I did.
And that's a pretty unique experience to have. And you knew as a kid that you wanted to be a SEAL, right? There was no question about it.
There was no question about it, man. I had, you know, the camouflage bedspread. My mom actually made me camouflage curtains for the room. Nice. My walls were covered in like all the recruiting posters and all the crazy shit. Yeah, I was really, really into it, but not enough. But you know, all that being surrounded by that, still, it wasn't enough motivation to keep me out of trouble. Right? It was just like one of those things of like, you know, kids are going to do what they're going to do. You know, not really looking too far into the future.
Well, right. It's you know, it happens to a lot of people. And look, some people pick it up quicker than others, but you know, some people just have to learn the hard way, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, I definitely took the hard route.
Okay. So you got out of the Marine Corps, joined the Navy same day. And then did you go straight into BUDS, or how'd that work out for you?
So I went to I swore into the Navy. So basically that same day I drove over to a transitioning, they called it transitional processing barracks, whatever. And I checked in and they're like, hey, where's your ID card? I'm like, no, I literally just joined the Navy like an hour ago. So, you know, so I literally go over to personnel. I get an ID card. They start filling out, you know, all the paperwork. And then I waited there. You know, we just PT'd every day and just swam and, you know, did that whole deal for about 5 or 6 weeks. And then the actual orders came where I was supposed to report to BUDS. And so that day, you know, me and a buddy of mine jumped in the car and drove across the bridge to Coronado from 32nd Street and, you know, checked in that day. And that was it, you know. And so then we classed up with Class 213. And I went through first phase and Hell Week with them, and about 3 weeks of second phase when I got a leg injury. They call it ITB. This nickname, I tried BUDS, because there's a lot of people who get it, and their leg and their leg gets fucked up, and then you know they end up not making it. But it's just an overuse injury, and it just hurts like hell. But I ended up losing about 30% mobility in my right leg. And I had a hip to ankle like they call it a soft cast where it just Velcro's on. And I was on that with crutches for about, I want to say 4 weeks. Then I was in physical therapy and then healing up. But I was there, I was a double roll, what they call a double rollback. So I skipped a full class and then waited for class 215. So I was in physical therapy for about 4 months. And then I reclassed up with class 215 and finished. But my total time there at Buds was about 10 months.
So this is kind of an interesting concept. Like, you know, I've talked to different SEALs and you'll hear these stories where guys got injuries and had to wait for the next class or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't that really kind of set you back, because you go into this in really good shape? You know, you're going through Buds itself, and you did Hell Week and all that. So obviously you're at the top of your game physically. You know, then having a rehab for a couple of months, is that like really a hard process to kind of get back into that shape?
It is, because, you know, you're constantly getting crushed on a daily basis, right? And there's a schedule and your body gets used to it and you start to get stronger and stronger. And then all of a sudden it's, you know, you're dropping anchor at full speed and there's no more PTs. You're just doing physical therapy. So, you know, but you're still there at Buds. You still have to do inspections and this, the daily grind of PTRR, is horrible, man. Like the motivation just gets drained out of you. You just, you know, it just sucks because you're not progressing. You're just, you know, you're marking time every single day. And then you see guys that you were in class with go to second phase and finish. You see, you know, they go to third phase, they graduate. And then you're like, you know, I ran the t-shirt, hat and sticker booth, you know, there on the grinder when my original class graduated. So I'm like, they're coming over and they're like, oh man, stay motivated, bro. And then like, hey, can I get a sweatshirt for my dad? So you're like selling them shit. You know what I mean? I'm standing there just selling them, you know, memorabilia and fucking hats and t-shirts and swag to the families and watching them, knowing that I'm not, dude. And I wasn't even in a class yet.
Right.
So I wasn't even in class 215 yet. So just like, it was just absolutely like demotivating as hell.
Yeah, I could imagine. I mean, you know, going through a selection is tough enough once, you know, and then going through it, getting hurt, having to wait and then go through it again. But, you know, I guess that's common amongst guys going through Buds, at least from stories that you hear or books that you read. And, you know, I think kind of a moment that anybody in the audience who's listening, who's thinking about going to Buds or whatever, is to, you know, not get injured before you get there. You know, I think that's kind of a good takeaway.
Yeah. Like I tell people all the time to not put themselves through Buds before they try to go to Buds. Right. So a lot of guys are like, hey, I take cold showers. I do this, I do that. And they try to, you know, put themselves to, you know, they're overtraining, right? Because you're never going to be able to do what that course demands of you. No, you know, you're not just going to walk out and be like, yeah, I know what I'm going to do today. I'm going to be a Bud student. And you cannot do that to yourself, right? No one, right? So the only way to experience it is to experience it. But if you're overtraining, you're not eating right, you're not, you know, following some type of regime and a discipline, then you're fucking yourself up long before you get there. So if you check in and you already have injuries, then the chances of you graduating go down dramatically, because, you know, any weakness is going to be exposed in that program. So if you already are nursing a foot injury, an ankle injury or shoulder, you know, something like that, or it's going to be, it will manifest itself within, you know, 30 to 40 days of that increased tempo on your body. You're just going to get smashed, you know?
Yeah. So now let's fast forward a little bit. You know, you get into the SEAL teams. Which team did you end up on?
I was on SEAL Team 3 in Coronado, California.
Okay. And then you were also a sniper, right?
I was, but not in my first platoon. Because you're just a new guy, so you don't get you don't get any cool classes in schools and shit. You're just there to learn, and, you know, as I say, you're there to suit up, show up, and shut the fuck up. That's pretty much that's pretty much the drill, you know. And to put out and, you know, earn your trident. Because when I went through that, you know, you still had to do an equipment you had to do a review board. And the Trident review board, you still had to do STT at the time, SEAL tactical training. They changed it to SEAL qualification training. So now the guys check in, they're already static line and free fall qualified, and they already have their Tridents when they check in. When I went through BUDS, and since the early days, you know, you checked in and the only thing you had was your five jump wings from airborne school. So we would leave, we would graduate BUDS, and the BUDS graduation was like the big deal, right? Where all the family and shit came out. Now it's the SQT graduation where everybody, you know, that's the big deal. But so we would leave BUDS and we would go to Fort Benning, Georgia. So that's where I went through static line jump school. And then from there, we kind of scattered off to our team. So the East Coast guys went to their teams, West Coast guys, you know, SDV, whatever. So when we checked in to the team, you know, you're just there with, you know, a few ribbons and your lead sled wings, right? So everybody knows you're a new guy. And then you have to wait for a slot for STT. And then we went through SEAL tactical training and, you know, together as a group, obviously. And then after that, you still waited another 4 to 5 months to take your review board. And, you know, so you basically just study your ass off and do whatever, you know, work around the different departments of the command and learn all the, you know, the different stuff that you can. And we would have like the flashcards. We'd just be studying and studying, studying. So then that oral review board, you go in there and it's all the E7s and above at the command. And that you just sit down in a room and they're all in there, man. Check it. Like, I've never been so nervous, to be honest with you. And yeah. they start rapid firing questions at you. And you had to know everything about weapon. I mean, it was, you know, when you'd ask, oh, hey, what are we studying for? And they're like, from the day you checked into BUDS until the day you walk in that room and everything in between. So, uh-huh. So they would be ripping off just random ass fucking questions, you know. And, you know, then there was, you know, guys that would have to, they would dump parts of weapons out and they're like, okay, got, you know, there's seven weapons in there. You have 10 minutes to assemble and do a weapons check. And then you'd be in there just fucking stressed out, you know, rods and springs flying, grips and shit. Like, you know what I mean? Just trying to, and then you do that process. And then they kind of, you know, give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down. You know, there are guys who have made it that far and never became SEALs because they just weren't confident or they, you know, just didn't have that final thing, I guess, the command was looking for. But there's guys who have definitely made it that far and gotten a thumbs down and never became SEALs.
Right. I guess you got to be able to kind of put it all together.
Yeah. Which is not like that now. Obviously, you know, they go through BUDS, static line, free fall, SQT, cold weather training. And then when they check in, they're full-fledged frogmen. You know what I mean?
Right.
So.
Right. Right on. And I know SEALs, you know, their inception was, they have a history through World War II, but when they were officially commissioned, they were commissioned pretty much alongside Green Berets. And, you know, you guys are similar in the way of kind of the jack of all trades in your skill sets. So what specifically was your role? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so when I checked into the command, and this is in, I want to say the summer of 1998 is when I checked into SEAL Team 3. So in those years, in those days, the teams all had specialized in a certain area of operation, right? So Team 3 was Middle East desert warfare, right? So that's all we did was desert warfare. SEAL Team 1 was jungle because they were commissioned in 1962, and it was SEAL Team 1 and SEAL Team 2 doing all the work in Vietnam back then, right?
Yeah.
So they stuck to their roots with the jungle warfare. SEAL Team 5 was mountain and cold weather, so they handled like the Korea Peninsula and places like that. So each team specialized in a specific region, and so all we did, man, was desert warfare. And so on 9/11, you know, I was up at Camp Pendleton going, I was just finishing Marine Corps Scout Sniper School. But so that's how I ended up in Afghanistan, literally like 6 or 7 days after 9/11 was when I deployed. So I had already done one deployment in 1999, 2000 timeframe And when we were working then, SEAL Team 3 and SEAL Team 8 were really the only ones that were kind of doing anything. SEAL Team 4 in South America was doing a little bit of stuff, but we were the primary team that was operating just because of our area of operations. So we were doing most of all the ship takedowns. So when Saddam was still in power, they were always, you know, smuggling drugs, smuggling cash, smuggling oil, and violating all the UN sanctions. So we were always – that was our thing, man. We would deploy. We'd be overseas and be doing ship takedowns. And that's where I really like kind of cut my teeth, so to speak, in special operations, was doing all those BBSS missions.
Yeah, and was that – and that's working as like in a specifically in a counterterrorism type of role?
Well, it's not so much counterterrorism because, you know, they're not – they weren't terrorists and they weren't, you know, holding hostages. So it's not like you're, you know, rescuing a hostage or anything like that. So this is – these are just missions that they classify as operations other than war. And all of them were, you know, highly classified at the time. So it never made the media you know, there was nothing – there was – nobody knew about it. We were just, you know, kind of operating in the shadow, so to speak. But it wasn't – what people would consider counterterrorism missions where we were going in to rescue anybody. They were literally, you know, ships that were up in the waterways between Kuwait and Iraq, and they were loaded down with illegal cargo. And as they would leave and try to make a run for it, when they breached like international waters, that's when we would do a ship assault, and then we would take the ships down. And then we'd capture the whole crew, you know. And then the U.S. government would take the ship and its cargo, and then we would be off like long, like before the sun came up, we were gone. That was it.
Right, and you said you deployed in 2000. Would that have been around the time that the USS Cole was hit?
No, I was in San Diego when the Cole was hit.
Okay.
Yep. I was already back. So, and then when I came back, we were off, I want to say about maybe about 2 weeks, like 14, 15 days, something like that. And then we were already back in another platoon getting our, you know, is now, you know, I had already had, you know, one deployment under my belt. So, you know, we call each other, you know, yeah, we're one platoon wonders. And, you know, so then we're getting the new guys in, and then now we start doing our workup, and it was, you know, like a 13 month workup. And then once we had finished that workup and we were ready to deploy, that's when we started going to school. So some guys would go off to free fall school. Some guys would go to advanced comm school. I went to sniper school, which I thought was cool. And so I went through the 10-week course up at Camp Pendleton. So I did that, the Marine Corps Scout Sniper Program up there at Camp Pendleton.
Which is interesting because you were in the Marine Corps, then you got out, joined the Navy, and go back there. And does that work just basically, you know, a slot was open for Scout Sniper School, so that's where you went?
It was, yeah. Yep. And at the time, the SEAL team had their own program, but there was no classes going on then. And I said, well, I'll just do the Marine Corps one. And then some of the guys that were running – you know, operations that help you with like the chits for all the schools and stuff like that. They're like, dude, are you crazy, man? That's their selection process. You're going to go up there and just get beat down for 10 weeks and for what? And I'm like, well, I was in the Marine Corps, man, and I've always wanted to do it. So why not? And so I went up there and did it.
Awesome.
Yeah. Which was cool though. It was a lot different, you know, being in the Navy because it had to follow, you know, the Marine Corps, you know, way of life, so to speak. So it kind of I brought a little element of, you know, just put out and chill. I wasn't as wound up as some of the guys because, you know, you got to think, man, they're lance corporals and corporals, and that's their selection. You know what I mean? To become a scout sniper, that's their school they've been waiting for years to go to. And, you know, I didn't have the same mentality, you know. I was just there to train and to learn and to try to get my quals as a sniper. It was good. I thought it was great, man.
So going to Afghanistan, like literally right after the towers fell, I mean, that's pretty historic deployment.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that at all? Like any, you know, maybe something that stuck out to you?
Yeah. So you know, about 2 days, I will say, yeah, 2 days before we were set to graduate. So we were just, you know, at the schoolhouse up there, basically just turning in all of our equipment and stuff. And we, you know, the class is told about the 9/11, right? This is 9/11, the morning of, and they're like, hey, man, have you guys heard what's going on? We're like, nope. So they're giving us information about the planes hitting the towers are being hijacked and all this other stuff. At that time, the school staff NCOIC comes in and goes, hey, Osmond, you got a phone call. So I go in there and I answer the phone and they're like, hey, is this Petty Officer Osmond? I'm like, yes, sir. And he's like, you've been recalled. And then I'm like, roger that. And then he hangs the phone up. So when all of our training and all those things, there's like these protocols, you know, when you get recalled. So I just walked in and I was like, hey, guys, thanks a lot. I'm out of here. Started packing up all my shit. And they're like, what are you doing, man? You can't just leave like that. I'm like, yeah, I'm out. And they're like, no, you have to, you know, and of course it's the Marine Corps, right? And they don't have anything like that or have ever experienced anything like that. So they're like, wait a minute, man, you have to turn in your barracks key. You have to turn in your linens. You know, you have to have your room signed off on. You got to this, you got to that. I'm like, guys, I'm not doing any of that shit. Here's my key. I'm fucking leaving. And they're like, you can't leave. Right. And I was like, hold on 2 seconds. So I pick the phone back up. I call the command and I get the XO on the phone and I'm like, here's the situation. These guys are trying to say I can't leave. He goes, who the fuck is there? And I tell him the guy's name and he's like, put that dude on the phone. And I just hear yelling and it's just, yes, sir, right away, sir. Understand, sir. Right. This fucking gutty, he's like getting his ass chewed. And then he hangs the phone up and I'm like, we good to go or what? And he's like, sorry about that, man. You got to go. So I just pack up all my stuff. And then they walked in and the students, you know, who I came to know pretty well, were like, hey, man, what are you doing? Where are you going? And I was like, guys, I really can't say anything, man. I'm out of here. So I was just like, hey, guys, see you later. So I got in my truck, drove back down to Coronado. It was just absolute chaos at the gate because, you know, obviously this is 9/11, the day of. And everybody's the threat, the security levels are like through the roof. But I finally get on base and there's, you know, I go up to where our platoon cages were at. So like each individual has a cage where his like personal shit's at. And it's just, there's shit everywhere. Right. And I say to one of my boys, I'm like, yo, man, what's up? He goes, hey, man, the OIC wants to see you. And I said, all right, cool. So I dropped my little bag and I went upstairs to our platoon space and you know, I was like, hey, what's going on? He goes, hey, listen, we're taking everything, pack everything. And I'm like, what are we packing for? And he's like, we're going to war, man, pack fucking everything. Cause I was the ordnance rep. So I was in charge of all the platoon's weapon systems. And so, you know, you always take care of the team gear first before your own gear. So I went right down to the ordnance. It was like wide open and all the SEAL support staff were there, right? They're like, hey. And everybody, because you know, everybody knows everybody. So they're like, Oz, whatever you need, man. And I was like, this, this, it. And it was just assholes and elbows, man. And so I spent the whole day packing everything, making sure everything was counted, you know, locked and tagged. And all that stuff was just, you know, set by the front door. And then there's now an armed guard 24/7 on top of that, like watching all of our shit. And then our platoon just kept packing. So we did that for the ordnance, we did it for our diving equipment, we did it for first lieutenant, which is all the maritime, like the boats, the motors, and I mean we did it for everything, our communications equipment, so our air operations equipment. So now we are starting to build these pallets of just fucking kit after kit. So we did that for about 2 days, little sleep, spent this, I want to say the third day, something like that, packing our personal shit. On the fifth day, we go into a briefing room and, we're told that NSW has been authorized, basically the West Coast has been authorized to send one platoon forward and that they were going to take an Echo platoon was going to go. And so all the guys in Hotel platoon are sitting there, right? That's our sister platoon. And they're just, you can just see the fucking, their face is drained, right? So we all walk out of there and we start busting each other's balls. We're like, yo, man, sorry you didn't get picked, bro. And they're just like, fuck. And they're just literally like, fuck you guys, man. So you're like, everybody's like bust each other's balls and kind of had like a little fun moment. But that night, we were allowed to go home to say goodbye to our families. And so I was in isolation, like no communication with the outside world or my family. You know, when you get recalled, you're on complete like lockdown. And there's there's no calls, there's no nothing, you know. So I go home, tell my wife what was going on, and she was like, "Oh my God," she's like, "You're like leaving?" And I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, I'm leaving, I'm out of here." And she goes, "Well, where are you going?" I'm like, "Don't know, couldn't tell you if I did." And she was like, "How long are you gonna be gone?" I go, "I have no idea." And that was it, man. So I was home about maybe like 6 or 7 hours, went back to the base the next day. And then they had the attorneys there from the JAG Corps. And they were, you know, we filled out wills, power of attorneys. We did all that shit and made sure everything was in order, that, you know, for us. And then later on that day or the next day, we went to North Island. And a C-5 flew in. I'd never even seen one. That's why the new shit was real, right? You hear about it and stuff, and you're like, "Oh, you're the tip of the spear," and you know, everybody thinks they're badass and all that. But then all of a sudden, this like empty C-5 lands, and it's completely empty. And they're like, "Hey, man, we're here to pick you guys up." And we're like, "Holy fuck!" So, we had like 7 pallets of equipment, put it on there. It was just the 18 of us, and jumped on that plane and flew. Up to Washington State. And so we picked up maybe like 6 or 7 Army Rangers. They didn't have any equipment or anything. They were just in their civilian clothes. And then they went with us, but then we ended up in Camp Doha in Kuwait was where we ended up.
Okay. And were you guys like kind of like forward staging?
Well, no one really – there was no like – no one knew what the fuck was going on, right? So – we were the first SEALs to leave the United States, right? We beat Dev Group and everything else. We left before they did, but they have a different mission set than we do. So there's already people deployed overseas, and that's what obviously most civilians don't understand when they're like, "Oh, bring the troops home, end the war," and they're chanting all their bullshit. What they don't understand is there's like 300,000 or 400,000 military personnel worldwide, always forward deployed.
Right.
And so we're now going there just to build up forces. We're not, there's already forces in place. So we went to Kuwait to relieve Delta Platoon from SEAL Team 3, who went into Afghanistan before we did.
Okay, right. Just kind of keeping that going, right?
Mm-hmm. So we get to Kuwait. And then, of course, we're like, "Hey, man, we're going in. We're going to be the fucking first ones in." Everybody's all excited. And you got to imagine, dude, this is, less than 2 weeks after 9/11, right? So you're pretty fired up to get some. And we get there and find out that we're not going. We're like, "Oh, fuck."
Oh, wow. So we were the hurry up and wait. God.
Yeah. So we were so bummed out. And then Delta Platoon guys were talking to us. It was the same shit we did to Hotel Platoon. They're like, "Hey, man." Hey. They're like, "Yo, guys, here's the remote for the cable here. Good luck. We're going to war." And we were just like, fuck. So, so they go forward and do their thing. And what was interesting, though, is literally – this is maybe 2 weeks later. So say 3 weeks after 9/11, call it 4 weeks. We're out doing our VBSS missions, right? The visit, board, search, and seizure. The ship takedown, the same old thing that we were, pretty highly trained at and had already had a lot of experience doing. And we're all pissed off now, right? Which is funny because we were excited as fuck a year ago because we're like, "Yeah, man, we're the ones that get to do VBSS." And SEAL Team 1 was never doing anything. Team 5 wasn't doing shit. So we were like – so the thing that was like super cool to do was now like a burden. We're like, "Oh, this sucks." But so the very first mission we did, though, after 9/11 was taking down a ship, Alpha 117. And what was interesting about that ship was that was the boat that Al-Qaeda used to smuggle the explosives into Africa, used in all in the two embassy bombings. And so that ship ended up being on a target list, and we're literally just happened to be in the right place at the right time because Dev Group was there, but they were way far south, And so that was a tier one target, but they couldn't get there in time. And it just had hit international waters and they were tracking it. And so they gave our platoon the mission to do it because we were really close to it. And so it was just by luck that we ended up getting that mission.
Oh, right. Was there like a documentary done about that or something about that?
Yeah, there's been – I mean, obviously there's I wrote about it in the book that I was a co-author of in 2008. I've done interviews on TV about it, but okay. But yeah, it was a big deal, man. It was like a no shit real world ship takedown of, you know, of national importance. And you know what, you know, I tell everybody, man, that's my favorite mission that I did out of all this shit, right? Whether with my first platoon, whether stuff I did in Somalia in the Marine Corps, stuff I did in Afghanistan with this at Team 3, but you know, that mission in particular, because you know, you get jocked up, you put all your gear on, and you get into the ribs, and you know, you got all your shit on, man. You got the night vision going, you got everything, you know. And at that moment, you know, you kind of like realize that there's no one else in the world right now doing this, right? So it was kind of a very unique thing, and very special to me personally, was that I just kind of looked around at my boys. And I was just like, yeah, man, you know, we trained for years and this is it, man. This is our 3 or 4 minutes to shine. You know what I mean? And that's what a lot of people don't understand, is that you fucking train and train and train and train and train for years to be great for 4 minutes. Right. And that's what it's really all about. And so at that moment, you know, you realize no one from any Ranger battalion ain't doing that mission. No Green Berets can do that mission. You know, we are the Maritime Special Operations, and this mission can only be done by us right now at this moment in time. And that was it, man. So that's why I like that mission the most, as far as it standing out in my mind as being the best one.
Yeah. And it, you know, at the time people weren't, at least, you know, civilians and people who are kind of in their own bubble weren't really hip to what was going on, because all this activity with Al-Qaeda and some of these other groups, you know, they were starting to hit at like American interests globally before 9/11 happened.
That's right.
And you know, people are maybe more aware of it now because of, you know, the books or whatever. But you know, this was kind of building up for a couple of years prior to 9/11. 9/11 was just kind of the, you know, the big event that really changed everything. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was, you got to think, there was the attack on the coal. There was the first Trade Center bombing. There was, you know, we had already launched Tomahawk missiles into Afghanistan, at, which ended up becoming dubbed Tarnak Farms 2, T2.
Yeah.
You know, years prior to that, you know, and we just never, the United States just never, you know, chopped the head off that snake and it came back to bite us, you know. So it is what it is. Like, you know, can't change history, but
right.
Yeah, but definitely.
And all of those incidents were connected. I mean, the first Trade Center bombing was done by the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was really the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks.
Yep.
And he wasn't a part of Al-Qaeda, but he worked with them, you know, kind of like, you know, on the same level as bin Laden. Not exactly, mm-hmm. but, you know, like he wasn't under him per se. But, you know, all this stuff was connected. These guys were doing things in the Philippines. They were doing things in Africa, Egypt. You know, this kind of transnational terrorism was already playing out on the world stage. You know, it hit home on 9/11, and then U.S. really shifted gears and focused on that.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think too that you know, there's people that are probably listening to this podcast that, you know, weren't around, that weren't even alive. You know, when some of this shit was going on, when I was first in the Marine Corps, you got to think, you know, I was in Somalia after Black Hawk Down, and you know, you got to think about the Clinton White House, and that was on their watch, right? And I think they really lost a taste, you know, for violence, for combat. You know, when you think about what happened there. And that being displayed on national television for everybody to see. And, you know, that's when they literally were like, hey, man, we're not committing the troops to anything. You know, so when I was in the last U.S. forces there in 1994, 95 in Mogadishu, we pulled out and that was it. And, you know, they haven't committed ground troops to that region since. You know, there's obviously people over there doing things, but not on some, you know, kind of like grand scale or some type of occupying force or anything like that. So, you know, all that stuff is going on. And then that entire time through President Clinton's campaign, you know, even, you know, just like the Bosnia thing, Sarajevo, all that was a, hey, we're just going to bomb you and not commit, you know, troops on the ground. And regardless of what anyone was doing to us, whether it's attacking our interests, you know, called the coal, the World Trade Centers, you know, all that stuff that was going on, we still didn't have a response for it, right? No one was paying for that. And so that, to me, emboldened the enemy to do what they did on 9/11. It was like, well, you know, it, and that's what, you know, caused, but now, you know, we are doing what we're doing, so.
Yeah, there was, it's interesting, there was a small, very small group, FBI guy, a guy from the FBI, and a guy from the Port Authority Police who were working together to try and run down like some of the leads on the first guy, the Trade Center bombings, and
yep,
and they kind of figured out, you know, about, they were kind of mapping out some of these guys who they were, you know, in the Philippines. Guys are running weapons and training and doing all these things, and they were tracking it. But it was really just a very small team of guys, you know, working for the government. And on top of that, they didn't even have like a full green light to do things. So it really just kind of happened, and it grew and it festered, and then it just all blew up in our faces. And
yes, it did.
You know, so what? So when was it that you went to Afghanistan the first time?
So I went to Afghanistan. So we were doing ship takedowns for about a month. And so our platoon ended up in Afghanistan the second week of December of 2001. And so we went from Oman. We had left Camp Doha in Kuwait and went to Oman. And that's where we're kind of doing like our vehicle preps and getting everything ready to go. And then we jumped on some C-130 Talons and flew in low level in the middle of the night. They were flying on NODs, which I thought was legit. And we landed in Kandahar Airport. And literally they, you know, as we landed, the tail ramp went down. We started the vehicles. We had done all these like practice runs with them in Oman. And so, you know, everybody has like their job. And so we literally land the fucking plane, man, does a U-turn at the end of the runway, and we drove our vehicles off, and that thing did a combat start and took right off.
That's, and so, awesome.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, you got to think of the different times, you know, no one knows what the landscape looks like, right? They don't know the air threats. They don't know, the air to ground missile, you know, no one knew anything. It was just like, there was no real actionable intelligence on the enemy order of battle and what they really had going on and how many there were, how deep they were. You know, the Green Berets were already there long before we ever got there and had linked up with the anti-Taliban forces and were kicking ass. So they were there long before we ever showed up. You know what I mean? Those guys did a fucking kick-ass job doing what Green Berets do best. You know what I mean? And they really fucking – they put the fucking boots to the enemy, I can tell you that. So, you know, we got to Kandahar. It was funny, man. The air control tower was already spray painted, right? They'd already marked it that they were there.
Oh, did they?
Oh, dude, it's fucking hilarious. Yeah, man. So, before the Marines showed up, you know, and it was funny because General Mattis was in charge of the Marine Ground Task Force at the time,
right?
And so that was cool meeting him when he was still a young general, so to speak. But he was there, and the Marine Corps was there when we landed. But you know, there's no doubt. I mean, it has to be said, and it's hats off, man, to the special forces, because they were there before everybody got there.
Yeah, they were there like at the very beginning of it. In the north, working, you know, fighting against Bin Laden and all that, and Taliban, and then also protecting Karzai when he first got back into the country.
Yeah,
Yeah. So what? So how long were you guys? Were you in Afghanistan? Were you guys there for like, you know, 6 months or so? Or?
We were there until April or early May of 2002.
And at that time, you know, what was the op tempo like? I mean, because things were completely different, obviously, from now and or, you know, even a couple of years ago. So yeah. What was that like for you guys? You guys were kind of just figuring it out as you went along.
Well, yeah. So once we got our first mission, the op tempo went through the roof for us. Because you got to remember, man, we're an unproven asset, right? In the sense of, even though we specialize in desert warfare, nobody in the SEAL teams had ever stepped foot in Afghanistan. And obviously, everybody thinks Navy SEAL, they think water. They think maritime special operations. And they're like, dude, there's not even a puddle of fucking water around you.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't your thing. But I always tell them, you know, people all the time, I'm like, look, man, sea, air, and land is an acronym, right? And it's not sea all the time, air some of the time, and land whenever the fuck the Army feels like it. That we can operate everywhere, and we have a very unique capability of just adapting around to our environment. You know, we don't need a lot of briefs and a lot of bullshit and we just adapt all the time. You know, I mean, that's what special operations is all about. It isn't about, you know, your specific skill set or, you know, your, you know, a specific discipline. It's like, hey man, when you get there and everything's completely fucked up and everything looks different than you were told and you have no maps and you don't even know which way is north yet, can you quickly figure that out, get together as a group, and change on the fly to be effective against an enemy? And the answer is yes, we're extremely effective. But that's what makes us different than everybody else. And I don't mean just Navy SEALs. I'm talking about our special operations community in general, right?
Yeah, right on. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
So can you share a story from this deployment, like a combat story? You know, we went on an operation or something like that with the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So the biggest mission that we're the most well-known for, you can even Google it if you want to, is the Zarwar-Keeley Cave Complex mission. So we were given this mission, and it was supposed to be a battle damage assessment, BDA mission, of, you know, B-52s had gone in and bombed the area. And so our platoon was basically doing follow-up. And our specific mission was to take pictures of the damage that was done to all the caves, and to take pictures of all the dead bodies and to do DNA samples on everybody. So we had these DNA sample kits so they could figure out who was being killed, right? You got to think they're doing these massive bombing runs. They've got C-130s at night just raining fire on people. But, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people are being killed, but they have no idea who the fuck they're killing, right?
Right.
And so, because it's just, you know, it's just a white hot image on a screen, you know what I mean, on an infrared screen that you're watching. So you don't know if that's, you know, Johnny Taliban or if that's the man himself, right? So no, so that's why we had all these DNA kits. And so that was our mission, was to go in there, but then there was the question of security, like, hey man, how are we supposed to be, you know, rummaging through these fucking caves and doing all these DNA samples with, you know, 17 to 18 people plus being able to hold security. You know, you talk about the scope of how big the cave complex was. And so it was decided that the Marines were going to join us. So 50 Marines were attached to our SEAL platoon and they were our perimeter security, which has never really doesn't make the books, doesn't make any of the movies. It doesn't make any of the shit that's been done about the documentaries, but you know, truth be told, we would have never been able to do that mission had those Marines not been there. You know, I can tell you, man, that it's a very good feeling going in and hitting a target, knowing that there's 50 fucking Marines. You know what I mean? Getting your back in your perimeter. You know what I mean? It's pretty legit.
Right, and it's all part of the system. You know, everybody has a role that needs to be played in order for things to work out. How they are intended to. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we took off from Kandahar Airport in, I want to say, four CH-53s, and we were packed with people and equipment. But the original mission was a 12-hour mission. It was just a quick on the ground, hey man, go in there, snoop around, see what you got, and come out. And, you know, we were told, guys, no matter what happens, you're coming out of there in 12 fucking hours. And so we get there, and the bombs basically didn't do shit because they missed the caves, or they didn't – not one of those caves was closed down. And we get in there, start taking pictures, start sending back all this data, start doing all these cave entries, right, which was scary in itself because – you know, it's like, hey, they could be booby trapped. There could be enemy fighters waiting in there. And the just how the caves were massive. Like, you could drive vehicles in them. They're huge. They had underground prison cells. They had lighting in some of them. Schools underground. It was absolutely insane of how vast the system was. The actual tunnel network was crazy in these mountains. But you know, you think about your brightest weapons light, your brightest surefire light that we had, and we would, you know, we'd make entry into a cave and be searching, and that light would disappear into the dark. Wow. It was insane, and we had never seen anything like that, right? So now here you are again, adapting on the fly, right? So we're used to doing like ship takedowns, gas NOAA platform takedowns, you know, urban environment, you know, type assaults, and next thing you know, man, you're now in a cave, and you have no idea. And it's, you know, they have fighting trenches in there. They've got, you know, you don't know if they're mine. You know, if you're going to step on a booby trap. I mean, it was pretty nerve wracking, but you know, you're not there to think about the worst. You're just there to perform at your best. So we just started doing our thing, and we started taking all these pictures, and all this data was being sent back, you know, to Kandahar. And so we work all day. We patrol out. We hit the, you know, as much as we could. We're just like, fuck, man, there's just too much. You can't do anything. So all the cave entrances were marked. All the, like, there was tanks there. There was anti-air aircraft guns. There was tons of stuff there in this cave complex.
Wait, so they were marked by the enemy?
No, they were marked by us.
Okay, I see. Okay.
We had gone through and marked everything with these GPSs, okay. Right? And we were just basically going to take all that data back so they could, you know, do follow-up airstrikes. So as we're waiting for our extract to come, our OIC is on the radio with our task force commander, right? We're in Task Force K-Bar. So he's on the phone, and you know, it's like, oh, no. So, you know, he hangs up. Then our head shit has a little powwow. Then they're like, hey, boys, gather around. And then at that moment, we're told that we're staying. And it was like, well, what's up, sir? I thought, you know, we were 12 hours in and out no matter what. And the headshed was pissed off because we had passed a bunch of grave sites and we didn't dig up the bodies and do DNA samples. So our logic was, well, they're already buried. Just, you know what I mean? There's nobody we're fucking looking for, right? But again, you know, it's brand new. No one knows what's really going on. They're trying to figure shit out. So they were like, nope, you guys are staying. So we ended up staying out there for 9.5 days.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, we had only taken enough equipment for that 12-hour mission plus 12. So we had about 24 hours worth of rations and water in case it got extended out there. But that's when we, you know, again, so we started, you know, capturing, killing chickens, a goat, small cow. That's what we used to feed the SEAL platoon, most of the Marines, because there was no MREs and shit was done. And we really started to go to work, you know. So we were nonstop patrolling. We had like this little village that we took over up on top of a hilltop. And that's where we all stayed. And then we would do patrols out of that. And then that – all those GPS coordinates and all that stuff, that ended up becoming our target list. And so day and night for 9 days, we called in over 200 airstrikes.
Oh, wow.
And it was the most ordnance dropped on an area target since the Vietnam War. And so we were doing a lot of work. You know, there was one time we were patrolling and ran into some enemy combatants, coming out of some caves, but they were really far away, about 500 meters. And we called in airstrikes and killed them. We destroyed an actual Al-Qaeda training facility, a training camp. So we took pictures of all that, and it was like where they were teaching people how to make booby traps and bombs and all this other shit. So we leveled that with an airstrike. So we did a lot of work in that 9.5 days. But it was interesting. But then after that mission, it was basically like, hey man, you know, these guys can do anything if we just send them in to do it. And so from that point forward, it seemed like every other day we were getting hit with another mission to go execute.
And that was the point that you said earlier where the op tempo just kind of shot through the roof?
That's where the op tempo went, like, through the roof, to where it was like sometimes it was like, Jesus, man. And then because we were part of Task Force K-Bar, you know, the German KSK commandos were there, the Danish, the Norwegians, the Canadians, Australian SAS, New Zealand SAS. There was a ton of special operations. It was like the who's who, right, of it was the all-star game of fucking spec ops. So we were allowed to work with all these people. And we mostly worked with the German KSKs because these target sets, you know, these areas that we were searching in these villages and these targets were huge. Some of them were massive. And so we just didn't have enough people. And so that's why we started teaming up with the German KSK commandos. And so, like, if you Google that and you see any pictures of, like, guys wearing three-color desert camo or solid desert camo, and then there's the German KSK, that was my platoon doing all those missions with those guys.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, Task Force K-Bar, that was a big kind of coalition of different groups. And I guess that's kind of an exciting thing, you know, all these different special operations units from around the world coming together and
right.
and going after it.
Yeah, and it was, you know, was I thought was super cool was that, you know, we had never seen any of these guys, right? But, you know, you read all the books, right? You read about their selection processes, you read about missions they've done and stuff they, you know, and then now you're there with them, you know, and you kind of like, you know, realize, hey man, they're dudes just like us, wearing a brown t-shirt and growing a beard and, you know, trying not to get killed. And, you know, you really, you know, that's where like the bonding and like the, you know, you get to really, you know, kind of, you know, lift the veil of secrecy off some of these units and some of these guys and just get to hang out with them and bond with them and become friends with them. I mean, some of those guys I'm still friends with to this day, which is crazy, but
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how long after this rotation, how long was it of your entire time spent in the Navy? Like, how long until you got out?
7 years total. So between the Marine Corps and the SEAL teams, I had 11 years of service. And then I, you know, three combat deployments. First in the Marine Corps was Somalia, my first platoon at Team 3 doing all the VBSS missions, and then Afghanistan. So each time I deployed, I was doing real world missions, which was fucking great for me anyway.
All right, cool. So can we let's transition a little bit and talk about you getting out of the military and then, you know, what some of that process was like for you, because did you immediately create a business or did that take some time?
No, the business was already going. So I had started Tactical Assault Gear in April of 2001. So this is a few months before 9/11, right? And it's, you know, I look back on that time, I call it Operation Enduring Training, where you're like just training your ass off. It's all you're doing, right? And, you know, sitting around the campfire talking about, oh, what if we ever go to war? What if it ever happens, right? And I guess it's a, you know, careful what you wish for type scenario. But so, you know, I went from the Marine Corps where you were issued certain stuff. And if you wanted anything nice, like a Gore-Tex jacket, you had to go buy it out of your own pocket. You know, it's obviously different now, but then I came into the SEAL teams, and then it was just, hey man, you're a SEAL. You can do what you want with all your equipment. You can modify it. You can throw it in the fucking garbage. You know what I mean? Most of those, you know, it was complete culture shock, right? But there really wasn't any, place in San Diego to buy equipment, right? And, you know, so the closest shops that I was familiar with were up in Oceanside, but you know, it's 45 miles away, you know? And you know, no one's going to drive all the way up there to get shit. So a friend of mine was friends with the founder of Blackhawk, Mike Knoll. So across from my cage there in the SEAL team, you know, I kept talking about gear and all this shit. And my boy's like, hey, man, why don't you call my buddy? He has a gear company. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, man, you ever heard of Black Hawk? And I'm like, no, man, I never heard of it. You know, this is like 1998, 1999 time frame, 2000, you know. And so I give this dude a call, and I'm on the phone with him, and I'm like, hey, man, I'm in the SEAL teams. I want to learn more about your stuff. And he told me there was a store in Virginia Beach off a Shore Drive called Extreme Outfitters. It's no longer there, but he's like, yeah, man, you got to check out their store. And I'm like, a store? He goes, yeah, all of our stuff's like on display there. And I'm like, okay. So I literally took leave and I flew out there and went to Extreme Outfitters. And I was like, holy shit, man. I was blown away, right? It's like a 5,000 square foot store. And it was just nothing but tactical shit everywhere. And it was sleeping bags, gloves, boots, knives. I mean, they fucking had everything. And I was like, it was like my aha moment of life. And I was like, if there was something like this in San Diego, you know, how could it not be? And the place was packed with people buying shit. But they had like Nalgene bottles. They were selling American flag hats, stickers. I mean, it was like, you know, posters. I mean, they just had so much stuff. And I was blown away by it. I was just like, you know, a gear geek from the start. And I was like, that's it. So I signed up to become a Black Hawk dealer in 2001. And that's where I started, you know, selling tactical equipment. That's how I got involved in all that.
So I know for some guys getting out, the transition is a little bit of a struggle for them. And then some people get out and they find that the transition is a little smoother. Would you say the transition was smoother for you?
I would say it was smoother because I had something to do, right?
Right. You already kind of knew what you were going to get into.
Yeah. Like I fell in love with being an entrepreneur, right? And I loved being at the store. I loved learning about the equipment, learning about manufacturing. I loved interacting with the customers and really, you know, being a in that world. And so that was something I fell in love with, and I still like it. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Still love it, if you will. So I got out in 2004, 2005 timeframe, and I already had a retail store, right? I had my own retail store in Imperial Beach down the strand from the SEAL teams. I had one up in Oceanside. And then years later, I opened another one outside of Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. But that was my thing, right? That was – so all my effort and energy poured into that. And what I see today with guys, you know, they'll do 10 years, 15 years, whatever, and they'll get out and they're like, oh, yeah, man, I was a Navy SEAL. I can fucking do anything. And then they realize that the civilian population could give two fucks about you being a Navy SEAL, and that means really nothing. Like if you're in a boardroom and, you know, sitting there in your suit and tie and reading a spreadsheet, you know, the fact that you are in Afghanistan after 9/11 means nothing. Right. It doesn't equate to success in the business world. All it does is open the door for you. Right.
Right.
So on the resume, it may say Navy SEAL or Green Beret or Ranger or whatever. And it, you know, but that just lets you get your foot in the door. You know, it's up to you to get in the room and be successful. And a lot of guys have a problem with that because you're coming from a world that, you know, only you really understand and the people who've been around you understand. And what you hold near and dear to your heart for being successful, like when you hold somebody in high regard as being a, you know, a pipe hitting fucking operator, that same person may be the biggest shitbag you've ever heard of in the civilian world, right? Because those people surrounding you don't give a fuck about physical fitness. They don't care that you can shoot a pistol better than everybody. They could give two shits that you're a badass with, you know, demolition and you're a breacher. They don't care less that you got 1,200 skydives. Right, that's your Halo Jumpmaster. That doesn't transition into the real world, as I call it. And so a lot of guys have a hard time going from being really well respected, really well known, to then being in a world where you can't even have conversations with a lot of people because they won't understand, one, what it is, or two, most of it's classified. Right? And now you have to listen to a fat bastard, right? who doesn't work out, who's got an ugly ass wife, but he's very successful and he makes a lot and he makes more money than you and he's now your boss, and it grinds on people, man. Right. Because there's, you know, the levels of excellence and expectation are completely different. you know, compared to the military. And so that's why a lot of guys have, I think they have a lot of hard, they have a hard time doing it. You know, right. You go from, yeah.
Yeah, guys kind of get hit in that kind of area that you just described, and it really kind of has some really bad effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, of course, you know, it's also on the person getting out of the military, you know what I mean? And you think, you know, it's not like you don't know you're getting out years before you get out. You know, you don't wake up one day and go, hey, Chris, did you know today's your last day here? And you're like, what? You're like, yeah, man, SEAL Team 3, we're letting you go, man. You're fired. You're right? It's not like that. You know for years when the fuck you're getting out. And so all these guys in the military, and girls too, that know they're getting out and they don't have a plan. They don't do shit. They think that they're just going to get out and they're just like, oh, fuck the military. I can't wait to get out. I want to live by my own rules and fuck the system, blah, 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 blah. 6 months later, they're, you know, they have problems, man.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people want to blame the military and fuck the VA and this, that, and everything, but it's not that. I think it's fuck the person who was in the military who didn't have a plan and, you know, thinks that somehow the world owes us something, right? Like I hate it when people are like, oh, thank you for your service, because I'm like, dude, I loved doing what I was doing. And you, the American taxpayer, paid the money to give me the weapons and shoot those bullets to do what I did. I don't think anybody owes me shit, you know, and that's my attitude. And I think that's, you know, probably some reason why I've had some success, because I'm not looking for thank yous and I'm not looking for accolades from anybody, and I don't think anybody owes me or any veteran anything. It's like, hey, dude, just, you know, and I tell people, look, man, if you could film the guys that are bitching about the military and you should be thanking me for my service and da da da, I'm a fucking veteran and blah, right? Go back 15 years when they were begging to get into the military, literally in tears. I'll do any job. Please let me in. Please let me in. Right? So they're their own worst enemy.
Right. And it's interesting, kind of interesting dynamic, because you, on one hand, you have a community of people who are out of the military and whatever their job was, whatever branch they were in, you know, people come from all different walks of kind of military service. And then it's just like, mostly you see this kind of online, you know, Facebook, whatever, you know, everybody's on Facebook, and you'll see guys like, you know, kind of jumping into the politics a little bit, and or whatever's going on, whatever the discussion of the day is. And then a lot of times you hear guys or see them writing about it, you know, snowflakes, or, you know, this generation, the millennials, are entitled and all these things. But in reality, a lot of, and not everyone does this, I'm not saying that, but in reality, a lot of guys are doing some of the things that they're accusing other people of doing, and I'm not even sure that they realize it at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that, you know, it's, I don't know, I call myself a liberal Republican in the sense of, like, I don't want anybody to fuck with me. I don't care what anybody does. I don't care about sex, creed, color, religion, sexual orientation. To me, I just think, you know, all humans are humans and people should just be left to do what they want. But I also believe that, you know, me wanting to own guns shouldn't bother anybody else, right? You know what I mean? Because I'm not in your house trying to tell you how to live your life. Why are you in my house trying to tell me how to live mine? Right. So that's where my push and pull comes from. If you strip out all the, you know, the politics of things, you know, it basically just breaks down to, you don't like me and agree with my lifestyle, I don't like you and agree with your lifestyle. And then people are just, you know, so polar opposite now. And, that, and of course, with the advent of social media, you know, people can get into online arguments, never be held accountable, and right. You know, so people just go crazy over the dumbest shit. I don't get it. I try not to get myself that wound up over things that are out of my control. You know, I try to stay in my little, you know, 3 foot circle and do my thing.
Well, I actually kind of agree with everything you said. I mean, you're right. People go crazy. And then with this whole online thing, you're right. There is no kind of accountability. You know, people will say things or whatever, and these are people you're never going to see, or they'll say things because they think they're never going to see you. You know, that all that kind of petty stuff. But I think people do get caught up in having an opinion on every little thing, and then feeling like that their opinion is the gospel and it has to be this way or the highway. When
right –
you know, I think it should be, just my personal opinion, it should be more along the lines of, you know, I do my thing, you do your thing, and everybody's happy that way, you know?
Yeah. And I do see it all the time, and I'm gonna, you know, participated in it myself. I think everybody has, is that you right. latch on to your idea of what you think is right, and you will argue to the death against somebody trying to get them to understand your point of view and trying to say, hey, man, you know what? Maybe you're right. And it's never going to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's better just to, that's why I'd like to hear people's opinions, and I can, you know, take away from that what I want. But I just think that, you know, when it gets so fired up and so crazy, people start threatening each other, and, you know, you've seen it all, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
With all the social media stuff. And like you know, like we say, you know, you if you could be held accountable, if there was an actual name and a real face to that, and your coworkers and your parents and shit could read what you're writing in secret in your mom's basement, people wouldn't be writing half the shit that they're writing.
Right. Right. It kind of adds a different dynamic to it. And
yeah.
It's interesting because it's a dynamic that humans never dealt with. You know, this is the only time where people were able to talk to each other from across the country, across the planet, you know, at like instantaneous speeds and interact.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all instantaneous, instant gratification.
Right.
You know.
Right. Okay. So, how long were you running this company, Tag Tactical Assault?
So I was running Tag until 2009, 2010. Officially sold it in January of 2010 to a larger, you know, government contractor out on the East Coast in North Carolina. And then I was with them for about a year and hated it. You know what I mean? It's, you know, I would sell the company again. I think it was the right time to sell the company. You know, I made a lot of money selling the company, which was cool. More money than I'd ever dreamed of. And even knew what to really do with at the time. So the financial security of it, you know, I would sell it tomorrow again, but I didn't look far enough into, you know, who I was selling it to and how that was going to affect me on a personal level. And the things I talked about before, you know, really resonate true with me is that, you know, here I am running my own company, wearing a t-shirt, riding my motorcycle to work. You know, I had a kegerator next to my desk. So when people would come in, be like, yo, man, you want a beer, dude? We'd sit down and we'd, you know, drink beer and talk shop and design gear.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, HR's like, hey, well, we have a no jean policy. You can't wear jeans at work. You can't wear a t-shirt at work. You're an executive now. You have to have a shirt and a tie and wear slacks and uncomfortable shoes. And it fucking sucked.
Right.
It absolutely fucking sucked.
Yeah, you get squeezed into that kind of conventional 9-to-5 type of deal.
Yeah, and you know, it was at that moment in time where I kind of looked around. I'm like, damn, man, these guys are really successful. These girls are successful, but they're all ugly. They're all fucking fat. you know, they're literally living to come to work. And right. I was just like, man, that's no fucking life at all, man. It was an education in what I didn't want to be.
Right.
You know what I mean? And about a year into that, I tapped out. I was like, fuck this. So I resigned as the vice president, as a vice president there in that company. And then I did consulting work for a few years. And then I got on the phone with the president of the company I sold it to, a guy named Bill. And Bill and I were talking, and he's, you know, because I was doing consulting work, and the brand was having a lot of issues, right? It wasn't doing so well in the market space. And I was like, well, look, man, I can, you know, maybe you guys could hire me on as a consultant, you know, because I'm the life, you know, the idea behind the brand. I was basically the brand, right? And they didn't have any designers. No one there had ever been in special operations. So it was just kind of a shit show for them. And he was like, well, I don't need a consultant, you know, would you come back full time? And I said, yeah, I'd drop everything I could right now and come back full time because I missed the brand. You know, I didn't miss the office environment at all and miss any of that, but I definitely missed the brand that I'd created. So I went back thinking that I'd be able to change it for the better. And it ended up just getting worse and worse and worse. So I was there for, God, man, almost 5 years. Living in San Diego, and I was commuting back and forth from San Diego to North Carolina. But things came to a head. And as I want to say about a year and some change ago, I started designing my own product for the motorcycle industry, you know, because I've been riding motorcycles since like 2002. That was my therapy, right? From operating and the op tempos and the business that I had. And that was the thing that I just loved doing, was riding my bike. And in that world, everything's made in Mexico, made in China. And it's just nylon, you know, stuff for your gas tanks, you know, magnetic bags, or for, you know, your handlebars or whatever. So I just looked at it as, you know, hey, I'll just use the same factories, the same materials, the same everything I use for military equipment, and just make it for, you know, the motorcycle industry. And that's where I started Chris Osmond Designs. And that's what I do full time now. You know, everything came to a head in the tactical industry, and they fired me from the company that I created, which was kind of, you know, poetic justice. But, but they did me a favor in the long run, you know, because I was absolutely miserable there. And I cannot even emphasize to any of the listeners how horrible going from special operations and, you know, being the best of the best and owning your own company, and then literally not needing to have a job, not needing to work, you know what I mean? But, and then being surrounded by people that you would never associate with, and that you just, in your mind, you just think are total dipshits and losers. And it was a mentally painful experience. But I lasted almost 5 years there. So almost 6 years in total, before it all came to a head. But now, you know, like I said, I've been doing my own thing again, getting back to my roots of being an entrepreneur and a designer, and really enjoying life and taking advantage of, you know, the things I've been blessed to have.
Yeah. You know, I think in regards to the whole 9-to-5 deal, I mean, that type of schedule and, you know, way of working, style of working, that stuff was made up in the, during the Industrial Revolution. So we're like running on like a system that was created, you know, 200 right. years ago or something. You know what I mean? So it's just like, it's really outdated. And then a lot of people share this same sentiment of really not enjoying life on the 9-to-5 shift, you know, even if you're making a lot of money, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's just, I call it a social experiment, right? It's a social experiment in a sense of like, hey, you're going to be in a building with people you've never met. You're going to be forced to get along, all to do a job that nobody really wants to do, but you're just doing it for money, right? So it's different than like the military. It's just the same thing. You're in a group of people you've never met before from all walks of life, but the difference is you all have the military and its core values and mission accomplishment, right, as the goal. And through that, you guys all bond and become lifelong friends. And then you experience life or death with people that really solidifies your relationship, right? In the civilian sector, in a regular job, you don't have that, right? The mission is just, hey, man, to be at a fucking meeting. There is no, you know, there is no bigger mission, right? It's not like you're taking a village or you're assaulting an enemy target, or you're going in to rescue somebody, or to save, you know, children from certain death, or, you know, I mean, there's nothing like that. So it's just this perpetual cycle of, you know, 9-to-5 or 7-to-6, and it's just absolutely boring with no end in sight, right? The only goal is for people to, they do it, be like, yeah, I mean, I want medical insurance, and hopefully one day I can retire when I'm 65.
Yeah, that's just like not fuck. Cool, man. Yeah, it just hurt. You saying that just hurt. Like it just hit my soul, man.
Yeah, and you know and there's no way to, you know, you can't really express how you feel to somebody because you get in trouble with HR, right? You can't if somebody is doing something wrong, you can't just be like, yo, man, you're really fucked up, dude. You got to pull your head out of your ass, right? But that's the way that I'm used to communicating with people, is just being brutally honest. And I expect the same thing, but there are people out there who get offended by curse words and they run to HR.
Oh, and yeah. It's terrible. Man.
Yeah. And then, you know what I mean? So then because people are so afraid to get in trouble for saying anything, no one says anything. And now you're just in this quiet office environment. Everybody walks around, not trying to hurt anybody's feelings, just so they can go to lunch on, you know, hey, punch in 30 minutes for lunch, 45 minutes for lunch. And you're like, if you think about it, man, you're racing, you know, to fucking Jimmy John's sandwich, choking down some disgusting processed meal. So you can get back to your desk, you know, fart your way to the final bell because you got indigestion problems from that disgusting lunch. And then your boss is like, yo, hey, dude, yo, where are you going? I'm like, I'm out of here, man. It's 4 o'clock. Hey, well, we're going to have another meeting. You want to stay till 5? And what do you say? No. So you say yes. And then it's, hey, you know, so-and-so's out of town. Let's go to a business dinner. Right. And that's all you do, man. Those people that live to just be in an office to work, those people are the walking dead, man. That is the absolute definition of what I never want to be. I would rather live in the woods and make my own fire and live off the land. You know what I mean?
Seriously.
Than to ever do that. Cause think about it. You go to college, you have all this fucking debt from student loans, and your reward for doing what your parents told you to do is to stare at a cubicle on a fucking flat screen for the next 30 years.
Just suck ass and hate every second of it, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's your reward, you know?
Yeah. Entrepreneur, you know, being an entrepreneur really is the way to go. And if you kind of think about it, it's really kind of a part of like the American identity, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, very much so. And I try to tell people if I could ever get across to people is the word security. You know, my parents were like, yeah, I'm doing this job because it's job security, right? And there is no such thing as job security, right? I thought I was in a secure job until somebody was like, hey, man, you're not wanted here anymore. Go fuck yourself. So is there real security in that? Think about, man, you got your resume filled out. You work someplace for a few years, you either resign or they fire you. There's only two options, right? And you go to the next job, resign or fire. Next job, resign or fire. There's no real security in any of that. I think if you're an entrepreneur and you find something you love and you can make it work, that's the real security, because you're never going to fire yourself and you can make your own decisions. And when you are an empowered individual who takes their life and their own destiny into their own hands, that to me is the real security. The people who make, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 a year as an executive, that's not secure. That's just money. You know what I mean? And every single one of those people are kissing somebody else's ass so they don't fucking have to resign or get fired too. They're just making more money doing it.
Right, exactly. And you know, it's financial freedom. You know, you want to be able to achieve that. You know, look, not everybody's going to be a successful entrepreneur.
Right. I
mean, it's definitely possible. You know, you have to kind of find your niche and put in the work and, you know, make it happen. But I think, like, true freedom is being an entrepreneur, being your own boss, calling the shots, you know, working for as much work as you want to work or, right, you know, whatever it is. And to me, that is true freedom. You know, not like, you can do what you want. You can go, you know, take your 2 weeks vacation every year or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, you're still punching in, you're still punching out, and you're, you know, you're sucking your teeth, you know, for as long as you're doing that. So,
yeah. Well, and you're thinking about, man, you're doing it for somebody else too, right? If you're working for yourself, then everything, all the effort you do manifests itself into self-reward. You know what I mean? If you get smart on taxes, you know, everything you spend your money on in everyday life, you're using post-tax dollars if you get a paycheck. But if you're an entrepreneur, you spend all that money at the end of the year. They say, hey, man, how much money did the business make? And you're like, $100. Because everything that a corporation is taxed on what it earns, not on what it makes. If that, you know what I mean? So you could bring in a couple $100,000 a year, but if you spend a couple $100,000 a year, you're not getting taxed on it because you spent it growing your business. On advertising, on meals, on the company vehicle, on the company, you know, car insurance. So, you know, you don't really need to make as much money as an entrepreneur as you would need to make in a traditional, you know, standard paycheck job, you know. And, you know, and on top of that, you have the freedoms to – I don't need to ask anybody to go on vacation. I can just leave if I want,
right?
You know. And to me, that's real freedom. And I think about it, you know, all the time, you know, all the friends of mine that have been killed and maimed and burned and all the crazy shit that's happened in the last 15 years. And I'm like, you know, was that sacrifice, you know, if I could go to their graves in Arlington right now, would they come out of that ground and say, hey, man, we did this so you could get a job and be in a fucking cubicle?
Right.
Right. They'd be disappointed that I was in a cubicle, you know?
Absolutely.
And so I think it's better to live like as an entrepreneur and to find something that you really enjoy. You know, everybody has something they are truly passionate about. You just got to find that passion and follow your dreams and don't let anybody say you can't do it, you know? And at the end of the day, you know, how much stuff do you really need to be happy, right? Because if you're happy, then you don't need a bunch of shit to make you happy. I think people who are miserable go out and buy 3 and 4 cars. People who are miserable have four flat screen TVs in their house. People who are, you know what I mean, they're trying to fulfill their misery void with shit. And I don't want to live my life like that. I don't want to earn a bunch of money just to buy stuff to have it that's going to eventually end up in a landfill. Right?
Exactly. And happiness is a choice, you know. You can be happy, you know, making $60,000 a year as an entrepreneur or, you know, whatever it is you're doing. But
yeah,
ultimately, you know, I know people who make very good money, you know, highly trained professionals in their industry, and they're miserable. And it's like, what's the point of, you know, going through all these years of schooling and training and blah, 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 to only get to where you wanted to be and still not be happy, you know?
Right. And they're making all that money and believing that they still need to keep making more and more and more when they could literally stop going to work. If they've saved enough money and they have something, they could literally stop tomorrow and change their lifestyle and work for themselves. But they won't do it because everybody thinks that, like, you know, there's like – like I said, I always go back to that security thing. They think that's the security of it. But I think that it's the most insecure thing you can do is putting your future in someone else's hands. And that's what you do at a job. And I'm not talking about the kid in college who's doing the regular, you know, working at the pizza parlor type job or the car washer, doing whatever the fuck you got to do to survive. I'm talking about once you graduate, you know, high school, college, and now you're in your career field, right? You're literally leaving your future and destiny in someone else's hands. They're literally looking at some piece of paper and saying, hey, man, well, you know, we've graded out your position. And in this state, for that amount of training, this is what your salary is.
Right. And
this is what you're worth. And you take that because you have to eat. Right. And that's it, man. The moment you say yes, you're in the rat race. You're fucking there, man.
Yeah, and it's difficult to get out. But for one thing I would tell people, because I have these type of conversations with people, you know, friends or whatever, and people kind of it is tricky to kind of find something that you like. I mean, some people can do it. Like, you knew you wanted to join the Navy; it wasn't a question for you. Not everyone is like that, right?
But right.
So then the question will become, how do you figure out, or you know, what do you do to kind of figure things out? And my advice would be to read books, because reading books, you can read about other people's experiences. You can read about other times in history where things were done, you know, this way or whatever. And that really, to me, is what is kind of opens up the world to you, because all over the world and all over history, people wrote books, you know, from all walks of life.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that's kind of if you're not sure, I feel like that's could be a guide to figuring out what it is that you're truly passionate about.
Yeah, I love reading. And, you know, I come from a time in the military where there was no iPod. There was no fucking iPhones. There was no iPad. So if you wanted to be entertained, man, it was a tape deck, or you were reading books.
Yeah.
So I've always loved reading books. And, you know, I always have a stack of books ready to be read. You know, and I have probably, man, I would tell you, in the last 20 years, you know, read well over 500 or 600 books. And it covers a broad spectrum of history, of business. And especially when I became an entrepreneur and really got into it, and really I was a sponge reading probably a book a week for like 5 or 6 years. And I'd always be in the library, always at the bookstore, always trying to find some new book that I could read. And I always liked reading books about entrepreneurial companies and how companies were really started. You know what I mean? And that was a lot of fuel for my fire. One of the better books I've read just recently is called Shoe Dog. And it was written by, Phil Knight, who's the founder of Nike. And it's not about Nike's success and how they became, $19 billion a year company. It is the first 20, 25 years of him struggling, of him going bankrupt, of him being in meetings and not knowing shit about finances, about, his struggles with marketing, with advertising, how they came up with the Nike swoosh, how he got sued, how he was in lawsuits. I mean, all this stuff entrepreneurs deal with, but, people only look at the success, right? And you take a company like Nike, you could take a company like Starbucks, any of those companies started off with one person, with one idea, with an unrelenting commitment to themselves. Yep. and to the brand that they created. And they were not going to fucking stop no matter what happened, no matter how many times they've been sued. And that's what makes somebody successful. That's what makes a brand a brand, right?
Yeah.
Anyone can be a manager at a Nike, but could you be the fucking guy that created Nike? That's the difference between an entrepreneur and a professional manager.
Right. Absolutely. And a lot of people, just from my experiences, day to day grind, I see that a lot, because I come from like an entrepreneurial background. I ran a company before. We had some success and whatnot. So I understand it, and I see both sides of the coin, running your own company and then, punching in, punching out. And you can just see it, like people, have such a small bubble that they live in where they don't see the difference between, really grinding and what that means versus just like managing the floor, do this, do that, or whatever, inventory, whatever it is. And yep. I think people just need to kind of broaden their horizons a little bit. Like I said, read. And through reading, you can, as you're reading this book, you can pick up on something else. And then you get two more books about something different that was just mentioned in this book. Things like that.
Yep.
And it really just opens it up for you. And it's interesting that book that you just referenced, I'm not familiar with it, but what I would say is that it's really important to understand the journey versus just the success,
That's right. Yeah. One common theme that is with all of these companies that I have found that just rings true with me is that, I've been sued. I've sued other companies. I have filed for patents. I've been sued, every company is the same. That there are a lot of people who get up every day and hope that you're unsuccessful, right? They're called your competitors,
yeah.
Right? My competitors hate my fucking guts, right? To this day, even in the motorcycle industry, right? I was not making handlebar bags for 4 months before a competitor started talking shit about me and bashing me and this and that. And I look back and I'm just like, dude, they do it because they know you're a threat. And people just have to wade through all of that. People have to just wade through the white noise of social media and the haters and all this. And I say it all the time. You will bust your ass for 10 years to be an overnight success, right? Yeah. It's the destination that's not it's the journey, not the destination, right? Like you say, to your point, everybody knows those companies because of the success they've had, but very rarely do people really go into the history and learn about all the struggles and of all the sacrifice that got them there. That's what makes them so successful, not just dollar revenue wise, but that they made it through all the bullshit and came out on the other side.
Yeah, and it's so important to understand that if you want to be successful. I mean, you literally have to be a maniac, and that's the only way that it gets done. Like, you have to eat, breathe, sleep, and shit your craft and think about it all the time. And in that way, you become this professional, or you become tagged, you know, gear. And it's really, if you look at it, you know, as a former SEAL, you guys spent like all this time and training, like maniac amount of hours perfecting your craft. And like you said, you know, we trained for years for this, you know, 3 or 4 minutes of actually, you know, running this operation where we were doing all this training for. And that's really what makes the difference between success and not success. Getting up every single day at the same time, you know, go to your job, get out, come home, you know, go to the supermarket, whatever, cook, hit the gym, whatever it is. Yeah, that's a routine, and it's better to do that than to be, you know, homeless on the street. But ultimately, you have to kind of get past that and work, you know, harder than that if you want to be at the top of your game, whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people, too, aren't ever going to become entrepreneurs because – not because they can't be successful in a sense of running a business or managing people, but most – the biggest thing I found with most people who don't do it is because they like to be told what to do, right? They don't have that natural outgoing, you know, personality. A lot of people are more introverted, and they want to be like, when's lunch? Okay, it's from 12 until 12:45. They want that routine because they feel comfortable with routine, which I think is – but in my mind, I think it's pure chaos. Like anything that's routine is chaotic to my mind. Right. Like internally, I emotionally get driven insane by being there at 7 o'clock every day, drinking the same fucking coffee, you know, talking to the same people, going to the same, you know, boardroom meeting, you know, talk about the same old shit. And it's like, you know, here's the task for the day. And they're like, hey, we're going to try the entrepreneurial operating system so we can better communicate as a group. You know, we're going to do this and that. And then nothing ever gets done. You know, yeah. It is paralysis through analysis. You know, they're just so busy meeting and trying to figure out how to better communicate. They're just like, dude, just tell the motherfucker what to do and he'll do it. Yeah. If not, shit can him. But they can't because corporate America doesn't work like that now. Right. You know, and so, oh, well, they got to be written up. They have to be warned. They have to this. They have to that. And literally, you can take years to weed out those that don't belong. Where if I'm like doing my own thing and I don't like that I'm dealing with somebody, I'm just block them on my phone and never talk to them again. It's like easy, you know?
It's so simple. And it's beautiful, too, to be able to do that. And you know, like you were saying before, you know, you go to Arlington. And you know some of your friends who were killed, you know, they come out of the ground and they look at what you're doing, and it really, that to me, like I said before, that's what it's about. I mean, just having that freedom and making those decisions and executing, you know, like people do their 40-hour weeks. I do minimum 50 plus every single week, and you know, that's I work a 9-to-5, and I run this company here, and you know, I'm trying to get it going to a point where I don't have to work the 9-to-5 anymore. But, you know, that's just the kind of effort that it takes. And it's just nonstop and people don't understand it. But, you know, hopefully, you know, audience people listening to this podcast, you know, they can take away some really good points from this discussion.
Yeah. I mean, and you're doing it, man. You are practicing what you're preaching, right? You're not just sitting back in the shadows, you know, talking about, yeah, I know a guy that did this. I know a girl that did that. You're putting it into practice, and that's why you're going to be successful, because you're actually fucking doing it. And then there's going to be a tipping point where your business takes off to the point where you're going to make that decision. Like, hey, man, if I keep going to work, doing this, working for somebody else, I'm holding myself back now, right? And that's the way it was with me in the military.
Yeah.
That tactical business took over my life by accident. And you know, my intention when I started was just to sell some gear to my friends and stay 20 years in the SEAL teams and retire out and then have my little shop in Imperial Beach. And it blew up into something way bigger than that. And I was just there and seized the opportunity. Whereas most people, it's like, nah, man, I don't want to grow. I'm afraid. I'm this, I'm that. And they talk themselves out of being successful, you know, and you're doing all the right shit and you're going to be rewarded for that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely, dude.
Yeah, so hey, Chris, so is there any website, social media, anything you would want the audience to go to where they can check you out and kind of keep up with you?
Yeah, so my Instagram account is how I do all of my communication. I don't do like email blasts and things like that. But it's Chris Osmond Designs is my Instagram. And then it's my personal/business account. So I do, you know, it's just me, like who you hear on this, this podcast, you know, rings true with that. So it's not just business and like, hey, check out this, buy this, but it's more of like my, you know, stuff that I do every day and my thoughts, throughout the week. And then plus obviously the business stuff is thrown in on there. The website is chrisosmonddesigns.com, which is being rebuilt right now. So the new website will probably launch in the next 2 to 3 weeks. So. But, you know, things are going good, man. And, you know, hopefully everybody will check us out and I'll get some more followers and we'll just keep marching to the beat of my own drum.
Yeah, definitely, brother. And I want to thank you for taking out the time to come on here and doing this. And, you know, I know you said you hated before, but I also want to thank you for your service as well.
Oh, thank you very much. I don't mean in the sense of like I hate it, like I don't like it. I'm saying is what I hate is that people are going out of their way to thank people just because they served. And right. Trust me, man, it's, you know, not all service is the fucking same. I can tell you that. And, you know, I don't think that it should be a crutch and the world doesn't owe us anything. And it isn't, we owe everybody else. And that's how I feel about it.
Well,
but thank you very much. Thank you very much.
All right, brother. Well, just again, thank you for doing this. You know, I appreciate you taking out the time and coming on here. And I know
absolutely,
the audience
man.
Is going to really appreciate this.
Yeah. Thank you guys very much for listening, man. I really appreciate it.
I had a great time talking to Chris, you know, especially when we talked about the transition process and some of the advice he had for veterans getting out of the military or planning to get out of the military. You know, we'd hope that people can take some lessons from that and plan accordingly. And then, as a result, have a better transition process. It was also very interesting for me, especially to hear him talk about the entrepreneur side of his life and studying business and what that's like and what it's like to be successful as opposed to the 9-to-5 type of daily grind that most people go through. So with that, we'll close out this week's podcast. We have some very, very, very good episodes lined up for you guys. Some really interesting individuals. My website is globalrecon.net. My Instagram account is IGRecon. The second account is Black Ops Matter. Check out my co-host and friend, Chancel Taylor, former British Army combat medic, on Mission_Critical on Instagram, on Facebook. Her page is Battle Worn, the Memoir of a Combat Medic in Afghanistan. That's also the title of her book. It was a very good book. I recommend that you guys check it out. My Facebook account is FB Recon. My Twitter account is IG Recon. I'm on LinkedIn, just search Global Recon. As always, we encourage you to subscribe, share, download these episodes with your friends and family. Leave a comment. Leave us a review and rating on iTunes. And that way, we'll continue to bring you guys high-quality content every week. And like I said, we got some good episodes lined up, so we'll see you in a couple of days. Peace.